Gorbachev, alarmed at the price the Soviet Union was paying for its Afghan campaign, had given Zaitsev a year to break the back of the resistance. And by the summer and fall of 1985, many Western analysts seemed to think that the Soviets were on the verge of pulling it off. The escalation had taken its toll on the Mujahideen, who, in spite of their warrior discipline and their astonishing faith in Allah, had become a bit war-weary. At the funerals of their fathers and sons and brothers and cousins, they rarely wept. They claimed to believe that they were happy for their loved ones who were now in paradise. But it was hard not to detect a certain exhaustion setting in. They were, after all, just people. The war had been going on for 5 years, and instead of things getting better, they were now facing an enemy that was increasing his ability to punish in ways they had never had to worry about before. For the first time that year, Avrakatos had to consider the possibility that, for once, he was playing chicken with an adversary who might not blink. He says, "This was the escalation that scared us, because here we were pouring in stuff that would soon double and triple their casualties, and that's what caused them to escalate in the first place, the casualties. We had to ask ourselves what would be left for them to do after that other than to invade Pakistan or to use tactical nukes." The well-publicized appointment of Zaitsev had created a kind of panic among the Afghan hands in Washington, but it turns out he was not the real commander. Instead, a far more lethal and politically important figure had been placed in charge. It seems almost incredible that a general as significant as Valentin Varenikov could have served so long in Kabul and been so little known to his American adversaries. Zaitsev was the subject of constant conversation, Varenikov none. It was as if the Kremlin had never focused in on the role that General Westmoreland had played in Vietnam. Certainly in his own world, Varenikov was anything but invisible. To begin with, he was an authentic war hero, possessor of the Golden Star of the Hero of the Soviet Union, a man whose history embodied the legend and mystique of the invincibility of the Red Army. It was Varenikov who was given the honor as a young captain at the end of World War II of presenting a captured Nazi flag to Stalin. From that moment on, the Red Army had been his life, and he had never known anything but victory as he'd risen through the ranks to become one of the three most significant officers of the Soviet General Staff. By Christmas 1979, when the Soviets marched into Afghanistan, he was the Soviet General Staff's man in charge of drawing up the master plan for all-out war against the United States and the West. As Varenikov matter-of-factly puts it, it was his job to design the strategy for the Red Army to fight the entire world at once and win, and he had no doubt that his side would prevail. In 1985, when the grand old strategist of Soviet power took command in Kabul, he was alarmed by developments in Eastern Europe, what he saw as a subversive anti-communist alliance between the Reagan administration and the Polish Pope of Rome. He concluded that the Soviets would have to choose a place to halt the momentum. As he set off to draw the line in Afghanistan, he was prepared to use Soviet power without compromise. During the 1980s, while Wilson and Avrakatos were still maneuvering to get into positions of power, Varenikov was in charge of Soviet military affairs in the Third World: Cuba, Nicaragua, Angola, Ethiopia, Yemen, El Salvador, and South Africa. In all those areas where the United States felt threatened, the anonymous hand of Valentin Varenikov was at work stirring the pot. In 1993, surrounded by rich oriental rugs in the Moscow apartment building where former generals are still given gracious housing, the general agreed to speak about Afghanistan as he awaited trial for his part in the failed coup against Gorbachev. He quickly made his American visitor understand how significant Afghanistan had been to him and to the Kremlin leadership when he laid out his dark vision of U.S. intentions during the Cold War. "It was America that started the arms race as a way of bankrupting the Soviet economy," he explains. "America loved blackmailing the world with its nuclear might." The general found himself even more alarmed when he learned that Reagan had launched a missile attack against the Soviet's Libyan ally Muammar Gaddafi. The White House and the Pentagon openly rubbed salt in this wound to Soviet pride by releasing a videotape from a tiny camera that had been placed in the nose cone of the American rocket so that the whole world could see and feel via television the experience of riding a U.S. Air Force bomb right into Gaddafi's tent. "What was I to think?" I knew Gaddafi very well. We were friends. I had just visited him in that tent the month before. How could we ignore these things? From the standpoint of the Kremlin, the early returns on Varenikov's series of offensives must have looked very promising indeed. By the summer of 1985, new floods of Afghans were pouring over the border seeking refuge in Pakistan, telling horror stories of saturation bombing, a new scorched earth policy, and the dreaded night-fighting Spetsnaz troops. What Gorbachev and Varenikov had no way of knowing that spring, however, is that they were moving with too little, too late. Back in Langley, Avrakatos had his own personal General Varenikov in place, 32-year-old Mike Vickers, and Vickers was going to turn out to be the better general. On one level, it was preposterous for Vickers to be playing such a role. He was so junior in grade that he couldn't even sign his own cables. But he was now speaking and acting in Avrakatos's name, with a $500 million war chest to use to wreck General Varenikov's campaign. And never for a moment did Vickers have any doubts about exactly what needed to be done. What Vickers, operating even more invisibly than Varenikov, came up with was a radical departure from Hart's concept of a massive mountain army. The brash young officer conceded that Howard Hart had accomplished much by arming a baseline force of more than 400,000. But because of the way the Afghans were armed, and because of their lack of training and sophistication, he was convinced that the law of diminishing returns had long ago set in. In fact, he concluded that even if the agency were to arm an extra 300,000 mujahideen, it would not improve their capacity to fight one bit. Vickers's first bold act was to cut off hundreds of thousands of mujahideen from the agency's main support program. Instead of giving the same arms and ammunition to 400,000 or more conventional guerrillas, Vickers decided to create an elite force of 150,000. Basically, he was betting everything on this new army within an army. The holy warriors, who didn't make the cut, would continue to be supported, but would be treated essentially as militia. To an outsider, it might have appeared to be a scaling back, but 150,000 was still a huge number. The Contra Army in Nicaragua, for example, was said to be no more than 20,000. More important than the size, however, was what Vickers had in mind for this core group of Muslim warriors. He intended to give them the most sophisticated weaponry and turn them into a force of late 20th century techno-guerrillas. Drawing on Gust's authority, Vickers was already channeling a torrent of new and varied weapons to the Mujahideen, but that was only half the battle. He had been appalled when he'd discovered that the agency was offering the Mujahideen only 4 or 5 training courses in weapons and tactics, none any longer than a week. Now, under the supervision of Marine Colonel Nick Pratt, the straight-laced officer who had been so repelled by Charlie Wilson on the Egyptian trip, the agency began giving 20 different courses, covering a range of irregular warfare disciplines, some lasting a month or more. It seemed to Gust that the Mujahideen had some generic gift for learning how to use weapons and instruments of destruction. His PM operatives, dressed in shalwar kamises with beards and chitrali hats, set out to train the Afghans in their Pakistani border camps. They were taught not only how to fire their new weapons, but how to work together in combat, and how to mount a range of different kinds of operations, from urban sabotage to huge combined arms ambushes. By the end of the year, the agency began sending in frequency-hopping radios and burst transmitters. Now, instead of waiting days for messengers on horseback, a commander like Ismail Khan in Herat, near the Iranian border, could communicate with the ISI in Pakistan instantly. With basic combat walkie-talkies, these biblical warriors were finally able to talk to one another in combat and coordinate attacks. That year, Art Alper's technical services people even came up with a small device that the Mujahideen could carry with them to give an early alert when a gunship was approaching. It would be many long months before Vickers could introduce his symphony of weapons to combat the Hind, but this exotic noise sensor, not much bigger than a quarter, was a godsend. It didn't just predict the approach of a helicopter, but identified the direction it was coming from, thus giving the Afghans time at least to hide. On every front, the CIA was turning its guerrillas into a far smarter and more lethal fighting force. Throughout the entire build-up, only a handful of people understood the role Vickers, hiding behind his lowly GS-11 rating, was playing. He would be in England negotiating to buy blowpipes one day and back the next, in Pakistan for 4 and back for 2, in China for 72 hours, placing orders for hundreds of millions of dollars worth of weapons, and back to the 6th floor, operating as if he had never been away. As Avrakatos explained, "He was our brain. I couldn't afford to have him away for more than 4 days at a time.